From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, there's a comedy festival this weekend in Sacramento. We'll talk with three of the comedians who you'll hear there. We'll talk about some of the ways that comedians get their material out nowadays. First, one of the biggest current foreign policy questions for the U.S. is how to deal with Iran. Relations between the U.S. and Iran have been tense or worse since the late 70s. A few years ago, President Bush proclaimed Iran to be part of an axis of evil. Tensions between the two countries today stem from the Iraq War and Iran's budding nuclear program. The speaker at today's World Affairs Council of Sacramento meeting is an expert on Iran. Nathan Gonzalez's latest book is titled Engaging Iran, The Rise of a Middle East Powerhouse and America's Strategic Choice. Gonzalez is also founder of nationandstate.org, an open-source foreign policy think tank. Nathan Gonzalez, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
How should the United States deal with Iran? We're told Iran is our enemy and poses a great and growing threat.
Well, I think that's exactly the problem. We are not really dealing with Iran at the moment. We are trying to stabilize Iraq in a vacuum. And the problem with that is that you can't stabilize Iraq without the involvement of Iran.
Why not?
Well, Iran's ties to Iraq go back actually over a millennium. And it stems from the fact that both countries are Shia majority countries, and religious and cultural connections are very strong. After the Iran-Iraq War that happened from 1980 to 1988, Iran began to foment a group of opposition groups that were to take over after Saddam Hussein would be toppled. It was understood by analysts, including myself, that once Saddam was gone, pro-Iranian groups were the ones that would come into power. And that's exactly what has happened. It's impossible to really talk about stabilizing Iraq without having some sort of discussion with Iran as to the future of Iraq.
Well, you can't speak for the Bush administration, but as far as you understand, why are they choosing not to deal with Iran?
Well, I think there are several reasons for that. Some of them, I think, are not in the interest of our country, ultimately, or our troops. I think there unfortunately has been a lot of focus on Iran's nuclear program, and fear of that nuclear program has precluded a constructive dialogue on Iraq, unfortunately. And the Bush administration has made it clear, for example, that they wouldn't have wide-ranging talks with Iran unless and until Iran stops enriching uranium. And that creates a problem for our troops. We have over 160,000 troops in Iraq at the moment. And I believe we're not in a situation to be putting conditions on how to stabilize Iraq.
The nuclear issue clearly is a source of tension between the U.S. and Iran, but it must be more than that because, as I said in my introduction, President Bush called Iran part of the axis of evil, a sponsor of terrorism several years ago. And tensions have been up and down, and mainly down for many years.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to the revolution. In 1979, of course, Iran took hostages from the U.S. embassy, and this action was sanctioned by the new revolutionary government in Iran. So the tensions have been there for over 25 years, and of course, it's something that we need to keep in mind. At the same time, a lot of the problems that stem from the revolution are more emotional than they are about strategic interests. If you look at the interests in the region, Iran shares more interests with us than, for example, Saudi Arabia when it comes to stabilizing Afghanistan and Iraq and having a majority Shia country that is unified in Iraq.
And they're neighboring countries to Iran as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're both neighboring countries. And Iran had a policy of regime change against both the Taliban and Saddam Hussein. We should be talking to them and not hanging on to the past.
Didn't Washington and Tehran work together, albeit quietly, after 9/11?
Absolutely. The Bonn conference in Germany that would decide the future of Afghanistan was attended by Iran, and Iran and the United States have worked constructively, like you say, under the table on the stability of Afghanistan.
Well, what went wrong? Why did that stop?
Well,
if it's in both sides' interest to work together.
Well, unfortunately, we tend to have a policy of regime change. I mean, you go back to the Axis of Evil speech in 2002, that was a the State of the Union address by President Bush, which he lumped North Korea, Iraq, and Iran together as some sort of axis. And since then, there seems to be a declaration of intent to actively work toward regime change in one way or another. And close confidants of the Bush administration are of that view that you can't deal with Iran, then there has to be regime change. Unfortunately, we really haven't tried to deal with Iran.
Do you think that this sort of covert alliance after 9/11 between Washington and Tehran was really just a temporary matter of convenience for both sides? Or was it just convenient for the United States at that time?
It was convenient for both sides, absolutely. Iran has an interest in the stability of Afghanistan, just like it has an interest in the stability of Iraq. And having a friendly government in both Afghanistan and Iraq is useful for Iran. However, at the same time, when it comes to Iraq, we have to see that our behavior was different going into Iraq than it was going into Afghanistan. And I'll explain what I mean by that. In the spring of 2003, after our invasion, President Khatami of Iran sent a letter to Washington through the Swiss embassy offering to stop support for Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and to put on the table their nuclear program for negotiation. The Bush administration not only ignored the offer, but it even scolded the Swiss embassy for passing the message on.
But why did the U.S. not take Iran up on that when not long before that the U.S. had been working with Iran?
Well, the reason, I believe, is because the Bush administration, after Afghanistan, settled on a policy of regime change toward Iran. And the declaration of this policy was the Axis of Evil speech, the State of the Union address of 2002. I believe their policy actually changed between 2001 and 2002. And I believe it's a reflection of who was who had the president's ear more at that time.
Wasn't the U.S. working with Iran at that time, around the time when President Bush was saying that Iran was part of the Axis of Evil? Were two things, separate things happening at the same time there? There was a public declaration on one hand, but actual covert alliance, temporary alliance on the other hand?
Yeah, but I wouldn't call it an alliance because it happened more on the ground level, at the more tactical level, at the embassy level. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen at the highest levels. It wasn't like the President Bush was on the phone with the Supreme Leader of Iran or anything like that. It was a policy that, as you say, was convenient for Washington, but that they moved away from when they were gearing up for war with Iraq, which was unfortunate because common sense would dictate that we would need the same or more support from Iran to stabilize Iraq than we did even in Afghanistan.
My guest is Nathan Gonzalez. He's the author of Engaging Iran, The Rise of a Middle East Powerhouse and America's Strategic Choice. He's in Sacramento today to speak to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. It starts later this afternoon. There are more details on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. So was this a wasted opportunity in relations between the U.S. and Iran?
Absolutely, and it continues to be a wasted opportunity. We have to remember that Iran has, as I said, is the only country that has an interest in having Shia majority rule in Iraq, which is what we brought to Iraq. And so by not sitting down and talking to the country that has not only shares our interests, but has the largest footprint, if you will, of the regional powers inside Iraq, it makes it very difficult for us to ever imagine a situation where our troops can pull out amicably. Mm-hmm. If we go into conflict with Iran, as some members of the administration have alluded to, at least as a possibility, the problem with that is that we would no longer be able to move our troops easily because it would amount to ceding large amounts of territory to a military adversary. It would never happen. And so you can bet that our troops will stay in Iraq much longer if we do confront Iran militarily.
Iran has a different president today than it did back in 2002, and it seems to me that Ahmadinejad is more hostile to the war of the United States than the previous president of Iran. Is that a fair thing to say?
I don't think it's a fair thing to say. Hostile is not not a fair thing to say when it comes to the president of Iran. I think the president of Iran does not handle the bigger questions of its foreign policy that lies with the supreme leader, which is an unelected office in Iran.
Could you tell us more about that?
Sure. After the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, who who was able to jostle power away from his co-revolutionaries, came to power and created a system by which a religious leader would become the supreme leader of the country. Now, under him, and if you will, in the pyramid of power, if you will, there are elected offices such as the parliament and assembly of experts and the president. The president has some powers, and he forms a cabinet, but he does not have power over the judiciary, which is one of the most powerful instruments of the supreme leader, and he does not have power to significantly alter the foreign policy, and certainly not over the military.
When you look at how relations between the U.S. and Iran have worsened in recent years, but there was a possible opening to improve them a few years back, how would you apportion blame? Would you say the U.S. and Iran, the governments, the administrations in each country, are more or less equally to blame for that wasted opportunity, or is one side more to blame than the other?
Well, I think over time, I think both countries have some blame. And we have to remember that there are various factions within Iran, and hardliners in Iran have an interest in having some sort of a confrontation. If not at the military levels, certainly they want some sort of verbal confrontation, because that empowers them domestically. So that there's certainly there are actors inside Iran who have an interest in not making relations work. But the overwhelming majority of Iranians certainly don't want a war, and that includes members of the regime. So there's absolutely enough blame to go around with the Clinton administration in Iran. But at the same time, I think right now we're in a situation where, for the first time in a long time, we really need Iran, and that is to stabilize Iraq and to be on the same page. We didn't really need that before.
Iran is enriching uranium. The government there says that their goal is nuclear energy, but the U.S. And its allies, and even countries that are not allied with the U.S., are concerned or even convinced that Iran's real goal is to build nuclear weapons. What do you think is happening? Do you think Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons?
Well, I think there's some consensus around the idea that they want to have the capability of having a nuclear weapon in a short period of time after they reach a certain threshold. That's exactly what the Shah wanted. The Shah began this nuclear program. This is the pro-American king before the revolution. And there seems to be a lot of analysts who believe that Iran wants to be close to a nuclear weapon, but not necessarily have to carry the burden of having one and potentially having to go back on it if enough pressure is mounted on it. I think the bigger question is whether that really is a huge strategic challenge, as people make it out to be. It certainly isn't the end of the world.
Why not?
Well, I think there's a lot of emotion around the nuclear issue, and a lot of it is coming from the comments by President Ahmadinejad, anti-Semitic statements that he has made about Israel and about how he wishes that one day Israel will no longer exist. And people kind of mistranslate that to mean that he wants to wipe Israel off the map. Whatever that may be, Israel has a nuclear deterrent. Israel sits on Muslim holy ground, so no radical fanatic would want to destroy the third holiest site in Islam in Jerusalem. So I think we need to bring down the tone of the hysteria and really look at this from a cool-headed perspective and what's in the best interest of our troops. And I should lastly say that Iran is judged even up to a decade away from a nuclear device. People who are putting the date a lot closer are people who also told us that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they're not getting their information from reliable sources.
The Bush administration says that Iran is sponsoring, arming, supporting insurgents who are fighting and therefore also killing Americans in Iraq. Do you believe that?
I believe that that is probably what Iran wants to do if it feels that we're going to use our military instruments to cause regime change. I mean, we have to remember that.
Isn't this a vicious circle, though? Because it seems the Bush administration is using that as seems to be trying to create that as the foundation of a rationale for striking Iran. The fact that Iran might be supporting insurgents in Iraq, but you're saying that perhaps Iran is supporting the insurgents because it's worried the United States is going to attack it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a vicious circle, and we have to go back to that letter that Iran sent at the the start of the Iraq War. I mean, there's this idea that the Bush administration wanted to, quote, do Iran next, as Bob Woodward quoted in his book. It might have been a joke. It might have not been a joke that George W. Bush wanted to do Iran next after success in Iraq. So Iran has been playing this balancing act of, on the one hand, it wants the Shia-majority government to succeed, as we created it in Iraq. At the same time, it does not want to free up U.S. resources to just turn around and attack it. So this, the accusations against Iran are probably, are coming from credible sources. And the type of weaponry they're finding seems to come from Iran, according to General Petraeus and Secretary Gates. The question is, do we have anything to say about that, and could we change that reality? Anything short of a confrontation. And I believe that if we actually try to sit down and talk without this cloud of regime change hanging over the negotiations, we might be able to get that to stop right away.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that Americans have about Iran or the people of Iran?
Well, I think there are many misconceptions. And I think the biggest one is that Iran is an irrational, self-destructive, messianic country. I mean, the biggest problem is that the government of Iran does embrace a certain image of itself as being irrational, because it helps it domestically. This anti-Americanism, what I call a cult of anti-Americanism in Iran, is stems from the revolution and from the consolidation of power that Khomeini used. Kind of like being a communist in China. Doesn't mean that China is a pure communist country, but you want to be in power, you want to have influence, you are a communist, you belong to the party. In a similar sense, being an Islamist, quote-unquote, or being an anti-American, quote-unquote, was sort of the calling card to show your allegiance to the government. It wasn't necessarily an intent of a foreign policy, because we've seen secret negotiations between the U.S. and Iran throughout the 1980s, the Reagan administration, and through today. So we have to stop sort of looking at this as, oh, Iran is an irrational country that wants to destroy itself, and we have to really talk about interests.
Iran is not a democracy, but how democratic is Iran?
Well, I would call it somewhere in between a democracy and a dictatorship. It has sort of the skeletal framework of a democratic republic because of its parliament, upper and lower house of parliament. It has an assembly of experts that is popularly elected, and that in theory, it has power to elect and remove the supreme leader, which is the highest office. And of course, the president is popularly elected. The problem with that is that the candidates are vetted by a powerful judiciary that is in the hands of the hardliners in Iran. So you don't have a pure democracy, but you do have participation on the part of the people. And the rates, the people vote in margins of up to 90% in certain elections.
Is Iran more democratic than some U.S. allies in the Middle East?
I would say than most U.S. allies in the Middle East, absolutely. Mm. Certainly much more than Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or Jordan.
What's the source of your interest in Iran?
Well, you know, Iran is sort of, it's a fascinating place. I have visited it, and it's a country that is sort of full of contradictions, if you will. It's a country that is conservative, and at the same time, it's very progressive. You know, Morgan Schuster, an American advisor in Iran at the turn of the 20th century, said, you know, Iranian women are the most progressive in the world. You know, even though that upsets ideas of convention, what people think about the Middle East, it's true. And so we saw women taking up arms in the 1908 Tabriz civil war in Iran. So you have all these really interesting, fascinating contradictions about the country, really progressive on one hand, really conservative on the other. And there's a struggle that's going on, and that has been going on. It will continue to go on. And I believe it strongly that it's moving toward democracy if we just leave it alone.
As well as writing the book Engaging Iran, you're also the founder of nationandstate.org, which is described as, quote, an open source foreign policy think tank. What does that mean, an open source think tank?
Well, the word open source has been sort of thrown around.
It's a software word originally, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I believe so. I mean, and Wikipedia really made it famous, you know, open editing, etc. We don't have the open editing function on there yet, as Wikipedia does. But I'm also affiliated with Foreign Policy in Focus, which is also an open source think tank. And what that is bringing diverse ideas from not only from scholars, but from anybody, foreign policy enthusiasts, who want to have a voice and want to have something said in a framework of a think tank that is not a blog, not just ranting about political issues, but actually having some coherent argument and presenting it, and while having the feedback comments of a blog.
And finally, Nathan, we don't have the time to do this justice, but I just want to touch on it anyway. An interesting sentence on nationandstate.org. It is much easier to tell Republicans and Democrats apart on domestic policy than on foreign policy issues. Why is that?
Well, because at the end of the day, we're all Americans. And I think, Democrats and Republicans may have strong views about, healthcare or labor policies, et cetera. But when it comes to defending our country, I think we are able to come together and we're able to use, hopefully, reason to achieve, to arrive at a conclusion that is best for our country. And I hope that we can come together in changing the current policies that I think are hurting our country in the Middle East. And I'm hopeful that we will move in that direction.
And why are you hopeful?
Because I think people have had enough of the politics of division. And I think people are, I look at the candidates on both the Democrat and Republican side for president, and people tend to be more level-headed. I think their heads are in the right place. I think there are people who are thoughtful and who are not ideological as the current administration is.
Nathan Gonzalez is author of Engaging Iran, The Rise of a Middle East Powerhouse and America's Strategic Choice. He's in Sacramento today to speak to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento. It's at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. Starts at 4:45. Go to capradio.org/insight, our website, for more information. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Comedy Festival in Sacramento this weekend. We'll meet some of the comedians. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A local chief medical examiner has studied brain injuries in football players. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll learn what he found and hear what local college football coaches think about it. Also, you'll meet the young Sacramento musician who's in the classical big league, a spot in the New York Philharmonic. Matthew Mucky is back in his hometown this week as a soloist with the Sacramento Philharmonic. Plus, children's entertainer Music Mike performs live in our studio. There is a comedy festival this weekend in Sacramento. The acts are from L.A. and the Bay Area, as well as locals. The festival is at Sacramento Comedy Spot. Today we're going to talk with three of the comedians who are performing. One of them is also the festival organizer. You'll hear about life as a comedian today, including the new ways to get material out. In our studio is Brian Krall. He's founder and managing director of the Sacramento Comedy Spot. And Tiffany Schultz, who's a comedian, performing in the festival. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Brian, you get comedy shows more or less all the time. Why put together a festival?
In Sacramento, you don't have a lot of what we do, which is improv and sketch comedy. And so we wanted to organize a festival that highlighted improv and sketch comedy. But then we also wanted to open it up to stand-up comedians as well. So we have a couple of improv groups performing, a couple of sketch comedy groups, and then we have actually one stand-up amongst us during the festival also.
Why is there not so much improv and sketch comedy? Is that a nationwide thing or is it a Sacramento thing?
It's a Sacramento thing. Sketch comedy improv is very big in L.A., very big in New York City, Chicago, major metropolitan cities. But in Sacramento, you don't see a lot of it. There are a couple of groups around town, but we have most of the people that are doing improv and sketch comedy. So,
well, what's the difference? Why is there less of it?
Excellent question. Something I've been trying to answer for 6.5 years. I don't know. The festival is partly our way of introducing people in Sacramento to what other cities have been catching on to for a very long time. So, yeah, it's an excellent question. It's very different. It's not stand-up. You know, it's a group comedy show instead of one person on stage. And honestly, I think it's a lot more fun than seeing just a stand-up on stage. So.
Brian Krall of the Sacramento Comedy Spot. Tiffany Schultz, why do you do improv and sketch comedy as opposed to stand-up?
Oh, I just love it. I think for me, there's just something synergistic about having more than one person on stage. You don't feel responsible for the whole thing. And the part I really enjoy is the improv, where it's all just off the top of your head. You know, we get a word suggestion and then we just go. And you know, I may have an idea when I get on stage, but because of the people I'm up there with, it just gets much bigger. So,
what do you do if nothing comes to mind?
You immediately abandon your scene partner and leave the stage. No, I'm just kidding. No, you hope at some point that inspiration will hit. And it is funny because it's often the most mundane things in life that end up being, you know, a basis for a good scene.
Are there some basic ground rules for the people who are doing that?
You know, we try and yes and each other, which is one of the first rules in
yes
improv.
Yes and.
Yes and.
In other words, you don't say no.
Right,
ever.
Exactly.
Like someone says, there's a horse over there. You don't go no.
The classic example is, wow, here we are in space. And the other person's like, hey, can you turn off the television? You know, that kind of stuff. You really want to go, oh, yeah, we're in space, and start kind of walking like you would in space and go from there. So,
how does that work? How does that lead to funny things?
Often it's the relationship between the players. Like if you can get some kind of emotion going, or a quirky interaction between the two, or maybe there's some, you know, there's a love thing that's lingering there and finally gets to be explored in this scene, which the audience is just like, oh gosh, please, please, you know, waiting for it to happen.
Brian, what do you think?
And when you're agreeing to whatever anybody says on stage, no matter what, that's where the scene starts to be funny. You're taking an idea, you're adding on top of it, somebody adds their idea on, and you're just simply saying, yes, okay, let's do it, keep on going, let's build on it. Instead of, like I've seen improv before, I've gone to high schools, and they're like, oh, you do improv, can we do some improv for you? Yeah, sure, go ahead. And then they have this scene where they fight, let's go over there, yes, let's go over there, no, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And it's not really improv, but you know, when you take an idea and you just keep building on it, and you never edit it or censor it or treat it as a bad idea, that's where the scene really starts to be funny. For me, that's what I love.
Yeah, well, it sounds good, but then there are bad ideas. We know from watching many Saturday Night Lives that there are lots of bad ideas.
Right.
And those are written and rehearsed.
Right.
So how do you, when you're improvising with people who haven't planned anything in advance, how do you stop it becoming a bad idea?
Well, we actually do rehearse improv, which is a strange thing to say. But we do a show that's very called Gag Order that's very similar to Whose Line Is It Anyway? So we have certain games that have a structure to them and certain places we're trying to get. So that provides us a greater, should I say, push towards the right direction, which helps. Also, you know, we try to play to the top of our intelligence. We really try to not do bathroom humor and that kind of stuff. We really try and push it further for the audience. The laughter will come from that.
Brian, any other thoughts about how you keep things good?
Yeah, sure. As an improviser, you also follow a certain rules of improv. So like Tiffany said, yes and, accept and build. Also justifying. So if something doesn't fit within the scene, you justify why it would be in this space. So there are certain rules that we follow as improvisers, and like setting a scene, you want to make sure that you're in a location and that there's a relationship between two people, things like that. You can always fall back on those rules to try and improve the scene and make it go someplace.
There are lots of good ideas that deserve a minute, deserve 2 minutes. Sometimes they get made into movies. Oftentimes, funny films, the worst part is the last part of the film because they don't know how to end it. Mm-hmm. How do you decide when to end an improv sketch?
Well, hopefully on the biggest laugh line, because that's where the reward is for the audience. They're like, okay, we all got it. We're all laughing, and let's hit it and get out.
So how do you make that happen? Who decides that was a big laugh?
Brian decides.
I always try to get out early. I mean, never let something go on for too long. So as soon as you get that biggest laugh, you jump right in there and you cut it off. And that's what's great about improv, too, is you don't have to follow a script. It doesn't end, okay, at this line, this is where we're going to cut it. You can end it at that big laugh. And
sometimes the story has not been resolved.
Maybe not.
Yeah,
but
and we can do more scenes to revisit that, too, later in the show, which the audience really enjoys. I do a show, a two-person show with Paul Burke, called The Paul and Tiff Show, and that one is all scenes. It's not games at all. And Paul came out the other night and was like, okay, we're in a duck blind. We're just two brothers who are sitting here waiting to shoot ducks. And so we made all the duck calling noises and sat there for a while and talked about the garb that we were wearing and that we weren't, you know, shooting down any ducks. And I certainly wouldn't have come out and said, hey, let's have this be a scene about, you know, being in a, you know, out in the field trying to shoot ducks. But it was great. It was inventive, and it was, you know, nothing really happened in the scene. It was just the interplay between the two of us.
My guests are the improv and sketch comedians Tiffany Schultz and Brian Krall. They and others are taking part in the comedy festival this weekend at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. It's an improv and sketch comedy venue in Broadway, and the festival is Friday and Saturday evenings. Well, Brian, you said you want to get out on the big laugh, but let's just say you miss the big laugh and it keeps going. What do? You just keep aiming for the next big laugh?
I'm a pro, so I never miss the big laugh.
Sure, I understand. But hypothetically,
if I did miss the big laugh, you just kind of have to wait sometimes. Sometimes you do the, we're just going to end it right there. You know, it's not a perfect world. Improv, trust me, I've seen it. It does go bad, sometimes horribly bad. You know, the more you do it, the better chances you have it's going to go. It's going to go the right way.
Is this a learned skill, or is it something that you're born with, Tiffany?
I think it's both. Definitely, there's some people who just have that ability to think on their feet, and can access a lot of different ideas. You know, they read a lot. They, you know, are up on current events. That kind of stuff really helps. And then also, you know, there's certain things that you can be taught about how to work with people in scenes. So I think it's really both.
Sounds like you need to be smart.
The smartest people make the best improvisers. I mean, over the last couple of years, we've had lawyers that moonlight as comedians. We've had financial advisors, people in the ad business. Your smartest people are your best improvisers.
Speaking of lawyers, Tiffany, you're a lawyer.
I am.
And tell us about what kind of lawyer you are.
I actually work for the state government. Mm-hmm. And I actually worked for a government agency for 7 years. And then I moved back to Chicago and studied improv at a Second City training company and also at a couple other theaters back there.
It's a pretty famous place to study.
Yeah, definitely. And just amazing theater every night. So I lived there for about 3 years and did that. And then I came back and I'm working for the state again as an attorney.
Did you go to Chicago because of Second City, or was that?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And also Improv Olympic. It now goes by the name IO, but like Tina Fey and a lot of the people who are on Saturday Night Live got their start at those two theaters.
What did you learn at Second City? What is there something special about Second City?
You know, I think part of it is just being around all these people who are doing incredible work that are just, like we've said before, really smart and really quick on their feet. And also you get the opportunity, you know, to try out for some of their shows and take their classes and just kind of see the structure of what works and what doesn't.
Being a lawyer for the state government seems like a very sober type of thing to do.
Sometimes it is, definitely. Yes. Yeah. But, you know, you get the gallows humor out of it, too. So.
I suppose so. Is that something that that works to your advantage or to your disadvantage when people know that you're a comedian?
I think my coworkers like me a lot because I do tend to go through the day in a pretty good mood, and it's easy to make them laugh. So, you know, they're a very receptive audience. A lot of what I do during the day is on the phone, you know, trying to get people to do things and helping them do other things. So the fact that I can infuse that with some humor, even though sometimes the work is pretty dry, is definitely an advantage.
If Sacramento were the kind of place where there was a bigger full-time improv and sketch scene, would you, in your ideally, like to do that as your job, your day job?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, how big a scene is there? How much work is there for comedians in Sacramento? Do you need to go outside of Sacramento to really make it work?
No. What we try to do is we try to give amateurs a chance to get on stage. And, I mean, we've been really successful over the years in drawing people to the Comedy Spot, giving them a chance to get on stage and try out sketch comedy and improv. You know, our later shows on Friday nights are times for us to explore. So we have shows that maybe don't go all that great sometime. But you're not going to get that in a bigger city like Chicago or L.A. or New York because there's so much competition. So, yeah. I mean, we're offering something different. We're giving people a chance to get up on stage and explore a little bit.
What do you mean explore?
Well, let's see. No, try different formats. Like, I'm in a show called Sacramento Royal Navy. I don't get to act much anymore, but they actually let me up on stage this time, and it's a sketch show. And my vision for the sketch show was a whole bunch of short scenes that all connect together, and the first scene will be similar to the last scene, so it'll all connect together and nice little with a bow on top at the end. And you know, I normally wouldn't be, if I was in LA or New York, I might be able to rent a space for a lot of money and put that show up. I get to do it at the Comedy Spot and get to see if it works. And, yeah. And it was a great show. It was a good time.
Well, and you know, one of the things too is with our theater here, it's just now really taking off. I mean, we've been doing this for 6 years, but now we have a space on Broadway, which is just up from the Tower Theater, which is great because right. It's easy for people to get to. And, you know, one of the theaters that comes to mind is actually in Fort Worth, Texas, where this is what they do. And they're a professional troupe and they do these kind of shows every week and people come and it's their theater. So that's just what we're starting to experience now. We have our space, it seats 40, it's got great acoustics, there isn't a bad seat in the house. And so, I mean, we feel like we're just on the beginning end of something big that can work here in Sacramento.
Brian, how would you describe the Sacramento audience for comedy?
The Sacramento audience, you know, very loyal. We've had...
Well, that's a good start.
That's awesome. We have people that have, I mean, that have followed us wherever we've been. I mean, we've played downtown. We've played out on 80 in hotels, and we've played, we've played at many different places. But they keep following us around. And
yeah, we have groupies.
We do. It's very cool. And what's really nice is I've always had this atmosphere where after a show, we go out and we meet the audience and shake hands and thank people for coming out, where you don't usually see that at a comedy show. You don't have a stand-up come out afterward and go, hey, thank you for coming. So
we get recognized at Applebee's.
Yes. Two or three times every 5 years.
We've hit the big time.
Feels good in the neighborhood.
Yeah. High fives. So.
My guests are Brian Krall and Tiffany Schultz. They are comedians, sketch and improv comedians. They are performing along with other people at the Comedy Festival this weekend, Friday and Saturday night at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. When we come back, we'll talk with another comedian who's performing there. And he's from Sacramento but lives in LA nowadays. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up by clicking on the little orange box with the word pod at capradio.org/insight. There's a comedy festival this Friday and Saturday evening at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. It's in Sacramento, of course, on Broadway. In our studio are Brian Krall, who's the founder and managing director of the Sacramento Comedy Spot, and local comedian, Sacramento comedian Tiffany Schultz. Both are performing this weekend. On the phone is another person who you can see at the Comedy Festival this weekend. He's Jeff Sloniker. Jeff, welcome to Insight.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hi,
good.
Jeff.
You're a Sac State guy, but you live in L.A. now. Why did you move to L.A.?
When we started out at the Comedy Spot, we were performing at bars, and we're having a great time. But I sort of wanted to see what other theaters had to offer, and I decided to go out and try the L.A. thing.
And how is L.A. going? There's a bigger sketch and improv scene there, I would think.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I mean, improv and sketch comedy are just, they're just taking over. Like, right now, stand-up comedy's great, but it's sort of died down a little bit. So improv and sketch are, like, the hottest things right now in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and now with Sacramento, with the Sacramento Comedy Spot. They're doing great.
I'm pleased to hear that, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Do you do stand-up yourself?
I used to, but I got tired of just doing the same bits over and over again and getting booed for the same bits over and over again.
Well, what's the difference? So, why were you booed for your work there, whereas it seems like it's going better for you in improv and sketch?
All right, let me clear this up real quick. Brian and Tiffany said you have to be smart to do improv, which is very offensive because I am not smart. I'm not a lawyer right now. I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm looking at the Hollywood sign. I'm in the Hollywood Hills. I'm overlooking a pool, but I'm a PA. I'm a personal assistant, so I don't get to set foot into that pool, and I'm hanging a rich man's paintings on the wall.
Seriously?
So, yeah, that's what I did today.
Wow, that's very interesting. Now, I was looking at some of your stuff online today, because nowadays you can look at people's work online, and I saw this hilarious parody you did of gimmick comedians, stand-up comedians. You showed in that you can actually do stand-up comedy. Tell us what you did in that.
I noticed that some of the stand-ups that are really hot right now are really gimmicky, like Dane Cook. Like, if you watch his act, all he does is repeat his joke over and over again. And it's not funny to me. So I thought maybe I'd do a little something, a little parody of that, and make fun of him and Carlos Mencia, who all he does is make noises after his jokes. So I thought I was the only one that saw that. And then I put it up online, and I got a lot of hits, and I got a lot of people talking about it. You got to watch out for the black ball, but I'll take it.
And Larry the Cable Guy as well. You did him too.
Oh, yeah, Larry the Cable Guy with Get Her Done. That's a hell of a catchphrase. I think a lot of people that shop at Walmart love that.
Those are good impersonations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just... you know, like, I started doing impersonations at the Comedy Spot. I did a Woody Allen, and my friend
said... Which was horrible, by the way.
Horrible.
Just horrible.
Yeah. My friend came, he's Jewish, and he said, I just don't like a fat, half-Japanese guy doing a Woody Allen impression. So I thought I'd branch out a little bit, try the wigs every once in a while so I can get away from the half-Japanese thing.
I'm talking with Jeff Sloniker. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. He's going to be in Sacramento this weekend for the Comedy Festival Friday and Saturday night at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. I also checked out some of your stuff on the website Funny or Die, which is a pretty interesting place. Give us a quick description of Funny or Die.
Funny or Die has been it was made by Will Ferrell. He's one of the producers of that website, and it's just dedicated to all comedy content online. Like YouTube, you could see someone fall off a roof and you'll laugh and everyone will be like, that's the funniest thing I ever saw, but they didn't put any like work into it. So this one has a lot of sketches, impressions, some people put their stand up on it, and it's become a real good website for the comedy scene.
Well, we're going to hear a clip, an excerpt from one of the videos that you have on Funny or Die. This is this is Mike Bush's dad, and Jeff is going to be the second voice that you hear. But we'll play part of it.
What's up, man?
Hey.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm all right. I was just at that parade. And...
Over there?
Yeah.
What's going on? I didn't know they're having something.
Mike Bush is dead.
Mike?
Bush is dead.
And that's why there's a parade?
Oh, no, they're just having that.
Oh. I thought they were having a parade because he was dead, and I was like, that is perfect.
That would be good.
That's what it was
but
for.
They wouldn't do that.
Well, they did. And we won't spoil the story by saying what happens after that. But tell us how that sketch came about. Was that improvised?
That was all improvised. A good friend of mine, Mike Bush, who is not dead, is one of the Alltel guys on the commercials you see. And we just met up, and we had a camera, and we said, let's just improvise a scene. And then Michael Bush started filming us, and we started getting angry about that. So we just did this whole bit about how he's dead. And he filmed it, we edited, and we put it up online, and we got the front page of Funny or Die, and we got a lot of people talking about that.
Yeah, because people who watch these videos can then vote Funny or Die, and the two that I watched, you got a majority of people voting Funny. That was Mike Bush's dad, and also another one, you were in Super Booze, there was a majority of Funny. It must be kind of nerve-wracking, though, when you go to see what people actually think of your video.
As long as I think it's funny, I don't really care. Like, I do like to see people really vote for it to be funny, but in the end, if you don't think it's funny, then why are you even putting it up? That's the nature of the business as well. Like, another thing that I heard you guys talking about is people don't like bathroom humor. Well, guess what there, Tiffany and Brian? They love bathroom humor, and I'm doing a great job basing my career on bathroom comedy.
This is why we shipped him to L.A.
Yes. And I still love bathroom humor, okay? So I can't wait till you come back up here.
Thank you, Jeff.
Now, Jeff, one other thing that I checked out this morning was a thing that you're involved in called Drunk America.
Where
you go out in the streets and you interview drunk Americans on very serious topics like illegal immigration.
Right. Definitely.
And it's really quite funny and illuminating, actually, surprisingly. Where did the idea for that come from?
A guy named Andy Cochran. He's in charge of the AV Club online there. And he just decided it'd be funny if we went and interviewed people and when they were drunk out on the streets. So, I mean, those were tedious shoots because we had to go out like 2:30 in the morning and wait for the bars to come out and try to get drunk people to talk about serious topics. And the thing here, like in Sacramento, you got some smart people, but in Los Angeles, the majority's not so smart. So when they're drunk and they want to talk about a topic, they love to hear themselves speak. So they'll say almost anything and they'll think they're really smart about it. And the hard part was to not laugh and snicker when they're saying things, because then they'll stop talking because then they'll feel self-conscious like everybody else in LA.
My guests are all comedians at the Comedy Festival this weekend in Sacramento at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. Just quickly wrapping up here, Tiffany Schultz, you're part of a group called Gag Order. Mm-hmm. Sounds very legal. Are you all lawyers?
No, and you know, we really emphasize the gag, not so much the... I mean, the name is actually kind of ironic because, you know, obviously with the gag order, you're not supposed to speak, and we talk quite a bit in that show. So
very good. Brian, I notice... that you teach an improv and comedy class each summer as part of the Sacramento State Academic Talent Search Program. What is that about?
Every year, the Academic Talent Search is a special program within CSUS, and they have these great classes, forensic science, veterinary medicine, and then they have me teach an improv class, which is super cool. So,
what do they think these academic stars are going to get out of that?
You know, a lot of kids don't get exposure to you know, the arts, and they're a little introverted. So you take my class, and they start to run around crazy, and their parents hate me by the end of the summer. But yeah, they just get exposure to the arts and performing, and it builds confidence. It really does. I mean, a very positive environment.
And Jeff Slonaker, are you bringing a group up from LA, or are you just coming up by yourself and joining a group that's already up here?
Oh, no, I have a group here in Los Angeles called The Great Adventure, and I decided to round them up and say, let's go up to this festival, because the Comedy Spot is what I wanted when I was out in Sacramento. I wanted to be thriving and have a little energy to it. And we had energy, but now they have a home. And I was just like, we have to go break it in. So let's go up to Sacramento.
Well, very good. Thank you all very much. On the phone, Jeff Slonaker, and in our studio, Brian Krall and Tiffany Schultz. We've been talking about comedy in Sacramento and the Comedy Festival this Friday and Saturday evening at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. Thank you all very much.
Thank you
very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear in Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, nannies and maids across the country have few rights as workers, but new unions and proposed bills of rights could change that. That story in the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer, Candice Mangouche. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Chief Medical Examiner has studied brain injuries in football players. On the next Insight, you'll learn what he found and hear what local college football coaches think about it. Also, meet the young Sacramento musician who's in the classical big league, a spot in the New York Philharmonic. Plus, children's entertainer Music Mike performs live in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.